It's September 19th, 2013 in Honolulu, Hawaii. And this is part one of practical service, which is the key to advancement. So today, we're going to be looking at how service is the essence of life and really the essence of bhakti. We're going to be looking at what is service in its most essential features. What does it mean to do service? Then tomorrow night, Krishna willing, we'll be examining how to do service in the nine processes. The nine processes and the 64 angas of bhakti. And then on Saturday night, right before we go out in Harinam, we'll be looking at how to do service in the world in terms of our, what we call our varna and ashram, in terms of our various talents, how to engage all our talents in Krishna's service. So we're going to be looking at tonight how service is the essence of bhakti. First, we're going to look at how service is the essence of life. Srila Prabhupada said, our sanatan dharma, our essential being, what we are, our essential definition, is a servant. So people often talk about, I have to do this, I have to do that. But really, there's only two things we have to do. They might say, well, I have to run to the store right now, or I have to take care of my mother, or I have to do this. There's only two things we have to do. Do you know what they are? I'm asking you.
Chant?
No, you don't have
you
to
have
chant.
To breathe.
No, yeah. Well, you have to live.
Yeah, you have to breathe, yes.
Well, you don't have to breathe because the body has to breathe, and we're a soul, and the soul doesn't have to breathe. Well, that's what we're supposed to do, but that's not what we have to do. What we have to do is we have to live. Krishna says, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future, so any of us cease to be. So the first thing we have to do is we have to live. We cannot stop living. If someone says, well, I'm going to stop, I'm going to commit suicide, does that mean they stop living? No. If you commit suicide, then simply the body stops functioning, but the mind, intelligence, and ego go on, and the soul goes on. And even if you merge into the Brahmajyoti and you don't have a subtle body, still the soul is always there. The soul is always alive and we're always an individual. So we have to live. And the second thing we must do, we have to do, besides always being alive, we don't have a choice. We can't say, I'm going to be dead now. I'm not going to exist. And the other thing we must do is we must
work.
Well, not exactly work.
Serve.
We have to serve. And serving means to give. Serving means to give. We are, our intrinsic nature is as givers. That's our dharma. We must give. Prabhupada says, like, the dharma of sugar is to be sweet. If someone gives you sugar and it's not sweet, it's not sugar. It can't be sugar and not be sweet. That's not possible. It can't be salty. It can't be salt and not be salty. You can't say, here's salt, it's not salty. So to be alive means to give, to serve. And those are the two things we must do. We don't have an option. We can't say, I'm going to opt out of existing or I'm going to opt out of serving. Anything else is a choice. Anything else we say, I have to, we're not being truthful.
Would you like the microphone?
I wouldn't mind it.
Okay.
Sure. I couldn't figure out how to set it up, but... Sure, that would be lovely. So that is because, of course, God's essence is a giver. God is ultimately a giver. Krishna says that he's the supreme enjoyer, Bhokta Ramya Tapasam. That Krishna is the one who's supposed to enjoy all of the sacrifices and austerities that anybody does. But that doesn't mean that God is a taker. God is a giver. But we got some kind of hum here. That sounds awful. Now, how can we know that God is a giver? Because everything everyone has is being given by God, yes? that God is the enjoyer of all of our sacrifices, but even if I do an incredible amount of sacrifice, I'm never going to do as much sacrifice that God will take as he will give. He'll always give me far, far more than he's going to take from me. Does that make sense to all of us? I mean, what do I have to give to Krishna, and what is he giving to me? He's giving to me, you know, beyond. Still making that funny noise. Yes. I'd rather no mic at all than the noise.
Rather,
no,
okay.
Just no. Thanks for trying. So this is also Krishna. Krishna is also giving. This is the exchange of love. And Krishna is the supreme giver. Krishna is giving everything to every living entity eternally. Krishna is giving to his pure devotees. Krishna is giving to the sinners. Krishna is giving to everyone always. And we, as part of Krishna, Mamai Vamso Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana, we are also have this nature of giving or service. And if we examine honestly, Prabhupada would make this point frequently, we'll see that even in situations where we think that we're taking, we're really giving. Prabhupada gave the example of the President of the United States. At that time, it was Nixon. He said, Nixon thinks, well, I'm the boss of the country, but actually he was the servant of the country, because as soon as the people in the country said, you know, we don't want you anymore, then he was out of a job. So the man may think, you know, I'm the master of the castle. Sometimes in Indian weddings, on the day of the wedding, the groom is riding on a horse, and sometimes he's even wearing a big crown. And there's a joke, you know, king for a day, slave for a lifetime. I don't know if you want to use that in the weddings.
Stay away from my weddings.
Don't come to your weddings. So the man thinks, I'm the master of the castle. You know, I'm the king of the castle. This is my home. My wife is here to serve me. You know, the old-fashioned view of marriage, I don't know if anybody follows us anymore, is that, you know, the man worked all day and he comes home and his wife puts on his slippers and brings him something to drink and something to read and something to eat and just waits on him hand and foot. Right? So the man may think, oh, I'm the master. But what's he doing all day? He's serving his wife and children. He's providing for them. And whatever position we're in, it's like that. We may think, I'm the master, but if we examine, we'll see that we're really the servant. Or the examples given of a pet. You know, you may think, oh, well, this animal, it's my servant. We used to have slugs in our garden. You know what slugs are? They're like snails without shells, and they were eating our plants. So we were trying to think of what we were going to do to get rid of them, and I did some research that ducks eat slugs. So we bought 2 ducks. And they did eat the slugs. They got rid of so many slugs that we didn't, after we got rid of the ducks, then we didn't have any slugs for at least 5 years after that. We had to get rid of the ducks because after they ate all the slugs, then they started stepping on the plants. They wouldn't eat the plants, but they would step on them, and they did more damage than the slugs did. But anyway, when we had these ducks as pets, I remember I was the main person taking care of them, myself, and then after that, the kids. My husband didn't do much to take care of them. But somehow they really were attached to him. And they could recognize the sound of his vehicle when he would come home from work. As soon as he round the corner to our street, they'd waddle over to the gate as fast as they could. And they would quack and quack and quack and quack to greet him. And he always said it was so lovely when he came home from work to be greeted like that with such enthusiasm. You know, quack, 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 quack. So people get this animal so that when they come home, the dog jumps on them, you know, and is hugging them and licking them, and they think, oh, this animal is serving me. But really, you're the servant of the animal. You have to feed them, you have to make sure they have a proper place to, you know, pasture and stool, and they have a comfortable place to live. If you go anywhere for any length of time, someone else has to take care of them. You're always thinking of their welfare. As one of my friends told me, you had an animal. At first they're cute, and after that it's work. So if you examine, we're always servants. Now, materially speaking, we don't like the idea of being servants. It says that the demons are envious of themselves. Prabhupada comments this in the 16th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And when I read that, I thought, how can you be envious of yourself? If you're envious, that means that you want harm to come to someone else. I want to take something. We're talking about that this morning. I want to take something from you. And I want to own it. You know, ultimately, envy manifests in the form of stealing. That you don't want to give me something. You know, you've worked hard for your money, and I want to go and just take it and have it for myself. So someone who's envious of you, they're malicious. They wish you harm. They want to enjoy at your expense. So how can you be envious of yourself? How does that make any sense? But if our self is naturally a servant, and if we hate the fact that we're a servant, then we're envious of our own self. And I remember my mother used to say to me, she said, when I go to pray at the synagogue, at the temple, she said, I don't say any of the prayers that says we're a servant of God. She said, I don't want to think of myself as a servant of God. So that's hating your own self. It's hating your own nature. And in fact, a lot of psychology is based on the fact that people's illnesses and people's problems in life is because they don't like themselves. I'm sure you heard that in psychology. You should learn to like yourself, to forgive yourself, and so forth. But what is the essence of ourself that we don't like? We don't like the fact that we're servants. That's why we've come to this world. We want to be the masters. In fact, we define loving relationships as to what extent someone else serves me. I mean, if you notice, when do we get angry at or disgusted or, you know, frustrated in our so-called loving relationships is when the other person doesn't act as my servant. When they don't do what I want, how I want, the way I want it. This is a hard thing to say, but if you start looking at that, you know, when do I feel really like, oh, this person's driving me crazy, I don't like them anymore, I don't want to be around them, or we get angry at them, think about it. It's when they don't do what I want them to do, how I want them to do, when I want them to do it. They're not being a good servant in life. This means we resent the fact we're trying to be the master. We don't realize, of course, that the real master, Krishna, is a giver. The real master, Krishna, is not a taker. The real master, Krishna, is finding pleasure at giving to his devotees, and giving to his parts and parcels. That's how he enjoys. He doesn't enjoy just by being a taker. So in our imitation of him, our meager attempt to imitate him, we do something that is not him at all. Now in bhakti yoga, the essence of what we're trying to do is revive our relationship with Krishna as a loving, willing, happy giver. If you want to say, what is the essence of bhakti? So we're going to look at this definition of bhakti by Rupa Goswami in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. That's such a nice name, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Sindhu means an ocean. So here in Honolulu, we're very familiar with the concept of an ocean. Here we are, practically right smack dab in the middle of the biggest ocean. And we are I believe that we are the furthest in miles from any other inhabited land. Most isolated place on Earth in terms of miles. I don't think we're the most isolated place on Earth in terms of hours of travel. I think there are some mountain dwellers where you have to travel more than 5 hours.
You can't swim home from here.
To get there. Yeah. So with airplanes, you can get here faster than you can to some other inhabited areas. But in terms of physical miles, we're the most isolated place. So all we see is ocean. We have some real concept here in Hawaii of the vastness of the ocean. So an ocean, bhakti rasamrita, rasa is taste. Rasa, it's a very difficult word to translate. In Ayurveda, it means the liquid taste. When your food is digested to the ultimate degree, it becomes rasa. The ultimate nourishment of your body in the form of liquid. And any tastes are involving liquid. We talk about this quite a lot. Not only what you taste on your tongue. You know, we do an experiment in elementary school where you dry off your tongue with a paper towel and then you put like sugar or salt and can't taste it. There has to be liquid on your tongue in order for you to taste. And the same with all the other senses. All of our senses are lubricated. You know, our skin has to have oil, right? We were at that shop today looking at lotions and oil. So your skin has to have oil. If your skin's all dried out, you can't get any satisfaction from the sense of touch. The same with your eyes. We have to be lubricated in our nose and our ears and so forth. So this rasa is this liquid taste, this liquid pleasure. And Rupa Goswami analyzes that this pleasure has seven secondary varieties and five main varieties, altogether 12 varieties of pleasure. Just like if we talk about physical tastes of the tongue, there are six tastes: sweet, salty, sour, bitter, pungent, and astringent. Amrita. Mrita means death. Amrita means not death, or life, or nectar. So this, and rasa is very much connected with the idea of life and nourishment in a very technical sense. So there's an ocean. Not just like you get a little cup. You know, we call our fruit juices and whatever drink we serve out at our feast, we usually call it nectar. On the higher planets, they really do have nectar, which causes you to keep, it's like a tonic that causes your body to stay youthful and full of vitality. So this rasa is the taste of life, the taste of vitality, all variety of pleasure, and there's a whole ocean of it. And this ocean is bhakti. So what is this essence of bhakti? That's an ocean of all varieties of pleasure that give life and vitality. So he gives this definition. Anya bilashita shunyam gyanakama anavritam anukulenan krishnanushimunam bhakti uttamam. So not only bhakti, but bhakti uttamam. Tamam means ignorance, uttamam means above ignorance. We can say the highest form, the purest form of bhakti. And we're going to look at this word shilanam. So there's a lot in this definition, but we're going to be focusing today and the next two nights on this shilanam. So shilana means action. You're doing something. You're doing something. We're also going to be looking these next few days at Nectar of Instruction, text 3, where Prabhupada says that bhakti is active work. It's not just, he says here, bhakti, this is an NOI text 3 purport. Prabhupada says bhakti is a sort of cultivation. As soon as we say cultivation, we must refer to activity. Cultivation of spirituality does not mean that sitting down idly for meditation, as some pseudo-yogis teach. Such idle meditation may be good for those who have no information of devotional service. And for this reason, it is sometimes recommended as a way to check distracting materialistic activities. Meditation means stopping all nonsensical activities, at least for the time being. Devotional service, however, not only puts an end to all nonsensical mundane activities, but also engages one in meaningful devotional activities. So this bhakti or service means you're doing something. You don't stop activities. You do this is shilanam. You're doing something. So I'm going to look at the commentary of Jiva Goswami on this word shilanam. He says the significance of the verbal word shil is twofold: pravritti atmaka, expressing action to worship, practice, and serve, and nivritti atmaka, expressing non-action, to be intensely absorbed. Thus, anushilanam, or continuous service, has an active form, chaste rupa, using the body, words, or mind, and an emotional form, bhava rupa, consisting of affection, priti, and despair, vishada, of the mind. So what are the components of this activity, this service for Krishna, which restores us to our original condition of service, who we really are, and the original object of service, Krishna? So first it exists on the platform of obvious or explicit or overt action. And that exists on three platforms: the body, the mind, and speech. And we're going to have this as a running theme over the next 3 days. That what service you're doing with your body, what service you're doing with your mind, and what service you're doing with your words all need to be there. Sometimes we think that devotional service just means the body. You know, I clean the temple, I cook the offerings, I dress the deities, I distribute the books. Or maybe we think it just even means the body and the speech. You know, I chant Hare Krishna, I talk about Krishna. But it also means the mind. I think about Krishna, I hear about Krishna, I meditate on Krishna. Now, of course, the mind has three activities: thinking, feeling, and willing. So the mind is composed of thoughts, emotions and desires. But here, Jiva Goswami is looking not only at the thoughts, emotions, and desires in terms of body, mind, and speech, but he's looking at what he says is an inactive form of activity. An inactive form of activity. Because he's saying this activity has two levels. It has the active form in body, mind, and speech, and then it has an inactive form. In other words, not something that's externally noticeable. On the platform of emotion, two emotions, affection and despair. Affection and despair, Jiva Goswami says. So a feeling of affection for Krishna and a feeling of despair in separation for Krishna. So our service for Krishna has to be executed on all of these levels if we are really going to be engaged in pure bhakti. Now again, tomorrow we're going to be looking at the 9 processes and the 64 angas, and Krishna willing, I have a little activity we're all going to do on the 64 angas and body, mind, and speech, which I hope you all enjoy. And then the next day we're going to be looking at what I think is really far out, how we can serve Krishna according to our activities in the world. Not just the 9 processes, but according to our nature in the world. But before we can look at that, we really have to get into what is this mood of service. If we're just working on an external platform with our body and speech, we're not really getting what bhakti is. Another really nice quote in this connection is in Prabhupada's purport to Bhagavad Gita 10.10, where he says, the qualification is that a person always engage himself in Krishna consciousness and with love and devotion render all kinds of services. He should perform some work for Krishna and that work should be with love. It's very possible to do service without a mood of affection and without a mood of service. And I apologize for those of you who can't see me, but one of my good friends demonstrated it very visually. And he said, it's the difference between serving like this and serving like this. So for those of you who can't see me, the first way is like if you put out your hand with your palm facing down, I'm going to give you something. I'm going to do something for you. Or if you put out your hand with your palm facing up, I'm going to offer something to you. So it's very possible to do service without a mood of affection and despair. First of all, it's very possible just to do service with the body and without the words and the mind. That's called Krishna Karmadi. You're doing some work for Krishna. But you're talking about other things and you're thinking about other things. So you're not really in bhakti if that's the situation. Like Prabhupada was asked right here in Hawaii, do you make faster advancement if you live in the temple? Prabhupada said that depends on whether or not his mind is on another subject matter. So if one's doing some work for Krishna with one's body, but one's talking about other things, or one's thinking about other things, that's work for Krishna. It will eventually bring one to bhakti, but it's not really bhakti. Bhakti means you're serving with your body, your speech, and your mind. And of course, this means serving Krishna and Krishna's devotees. So if I'm serving you with my body, but with my speech, I'm denigrating you. Is that service? No. If I'm serving you with my body and my speech, but in my mind I'm denigrating you, is that service? No, not really.
Impure.
Not really. You know, if the wife is cooking for her husband and saying, I love you, in her mind she's thinking of the other man she's going to meet at 9 o'clock at night, that's not service. Or if in her mind she's thinking, you lazy bum, I can't stand you, you know, Can't wait until I can do something else. That's not service. We all know that when we're the recipient of it. You know, that's not authentic. So to be bhakti, it's got to be body, mind, and speech. But it also has to be of a certain mood. So if I have the mood that I am so great, and I am serving out of my greatness, this is the mood of a lot of philanthropists. Sometimes devotees think that giving charity is mostly in the mode of goodness. It's not. Giving charity is mostly in the mode of passion. The big philanthropists, the big charity givers, are generally in the mode of passion, not in the mode of goodness. I'm going to do good for the world. I'm going to help the world, like our richest man in America, Bill Gates. He said, I can do much better good for the world out of church on Sunday than I can in church on Sunday. He's thinking, I can do more good for the world by spending my money than by worshiping God. One is then giving, but with the mood of God. Remember, God is a giver. He's a supreme giver. But God is the giver as master. God is the giver that I have everything. And out of my kindness, out of my mercy, I am giving to you. Although God is a supreme giver, he's giving like that. I am great and you are small, and out of my mercy I am giving to you. There's a kind of pleasure in that, isn't there? You know, the rich person who goes to the third world countries and has pity for the beggar in the street. Oh, I have, you know, $10,000 in my bank account and you have nothing. Out of my great kindness I will give to you. That is the mood of God. If we give like that, we're not in our constitutional position. And you can also tell when someone's giving to you like that, isn't it? We call it patronizing or condescending. If we come and think, I'm so great, I'm so qualified, I'm so talented, I have so much to offer. Everyone in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness should feel grateful for everything I'm giving. That's in the mode of passion. That's not service. I mean, it's counted as something because you're giving to Krishna, but that's not bhakti. So bhakti's got to be with the body, the words, and the mind, and it's got to be with this mood that I am the servant. Now, I'll admit openly that once I realized this, I also realized that I usually got it wrong. That my mood was usually, I'm so great and everybody should be so happy for all the service that I'm doing. They should all come to me and say, oh, Urmila, thank you so much for sacrificing your valuable time and your infinite whatever to help us poor little things. And that often that's what I was looking for. And it's quite interesting that often devotees will complain when they don't get that. They'll say, I've given so much. I've sacrificed so much. I had so much to give. I'm so wonderful. And people aren't recognizing and appreciating me. So why should I give anymore? I hear this all the time, all over the world. Well, I don't want to come to that temple anymore. I don't want to give anything anymore. I gave for so many years. I worked so hard for that money that I gave. And I'm so talented, and I'm so qualified, and I gave so much, and nobody appreciated. That means you're giving like this. You're thinking, everything belongs to me, and out of my mercy and my kindness, I'm rendering some service. Those people need me so much. The temple needs me so much. That's not bhakti. I'm the great giver, benedicting the world. That's not bhakti. That's trying to be God. And once I realized this, at least a little bit, I can't say I even realized it, but once I started to realize this, then I saw how rarely I was really being a servant. few months ago, I was in Bloomfontein, which means literally bloom fountain, fountain of blooms, fountain of roses in South Africa. There was a small preaching center run by one family. And the wife was constantly in the kitchen. It was a very kitchen cooking preaching center, something like this. Everything was just based around prasadam distribution. That was the engine of the whole center. And very, very similar to this. They had a little restaurant in the center where people would come and eat at the center. You know, a few tables, not like a big restaurant that seat 200 people or something like that. And then they did prasadam distribution for the university. And it was the wife who did the lion's share of the cooking. Of course, she had some assistance from other devotees. So she was in that kitchen morning till night, morning till night, morning till night, morning till night. And everything she cooked was just incredible, just variety. And she was really, really expert. And you could see she really enjoyed cooking. Whenever she was in the kitchen, she was smiling, she was singing, she was chanting. It was just such an atmosphere. And the temple was in just basically a house, a large house. And it was set up so the kitchen was geographically the center, whoever had designed that house, of the house. So wherever you would go through the kitchen. So wherever I'd go, I'd always see her cooking. And she was always just full of so much light and love in the kitchen. I was there for about 4 days. And the last day I was there, I was sitting right there by the kitchen watching her, and I had this overwhelming feeling of affection and thinking, I really want to serve her. Not like this, but like this. What can I do to help? And I didn't feel that way because I felt obligated, because I felt I should, just because I was so inspired by her. And not in an awe and reverent way, but in a very affectionate way. And the feeling didn't last very long. It lasted just for a few minutes. But I thought, oh, that's it. That's what I'm looking for. That's what I want to have. It was such a wonderful feeling. It filled me with, you know, warm fuzzies kind of thing. Where I felt very alive. Because that's what rasa is, as we were saying in the beginning. Rasa is what makes you feel alive. It fills you with pleasure. And I thought, yes, that is what we're looking for. That feeling towards Krishna and towards Krishna's devotees. And my dear friends, we can go on for days and weeks and months and years thinking we're serving and we're in bhakti. And if we're not feeling like that, we're not really doing bhakti. We're doing something else. We're doing some mixed bhakti. So certainly we should be busy, and we're going to get into tomorrow and the next day how we should be busy. Again, tomorrow we're going to talk about how we should be busy in the nine processes, and the next day how we should be busy according to our varna and ashram. Certainly we should be busy. Busy in the temple, busy in Prabhupada's mission, busy in our life in ways that further Srila Prabhupada's mission and further our service. And we should keep our body busy in Krishna's service. And we should keep our speaking busy in Krishna's service. And we should keep our mind busy in Krishna's service. But we should also have this externally intangible, externally inactive action that, as Jiva Goswami says, is not action. This mood of affection and despair. For Krishna and for the devotees. That I really care about Krishna and the devotees. How can this despair, how can I do more for them? How can I do more for them? They are great. I am not some great person with something to give these poor souls who are dependent on my greatness and should be eternally grateful for how I am willing out of my mercy to sacrifice my time and energy and money. But they are great, and I am privileged to be given an opportunity to assist. So how to cultivate that mood, which is what we're looking for. That's the Rasamrita Sindhu. As long as we have this idea that I am the great one who out of my kindness is sacrificing something for which I want accolades and recognition, we're never going to taste this ocean of Rasamrita, no matter how hard we work and how busy we are. You can work in the temple 14 hours a day, 16 hours a day. And if the mood isn't right, my dear friends, all you're going to feel is bitterness. I'm sorry. And we've seen this. You know, that's also charity in the mode of passion. Where Prabhupada says charity in the mode of passion, 18th chapter Bhagavad Gita, is given at the request of a superior with regret afterwards. And somebody can work hard for Krishna and the devotees, but if they're working hard without this mood of affection and despair, if they're working hard with this mood that I'm great and I'm giving out of my infinite kindness to people who are lower than I am, who should be appreciating me, then at the end there's just bitterness and regret. Why did I give so much? I shouldn't have done that. I should have done something else. I never got the appreciation that I'm due. And I hear this over and over and over and over all over the world. The devotees didn't appreciate me enough. They don't recognize my sacrifices. They're not loving me enough. I hear it all the time. And this is, frankly, the source of most of our criticism of our authorities in ISKCON, regardless of their real faults. Because we all have faults, my friends. But our main bitterness is that. Because we're giving in the wrong mood. It's the main source of our bitterness in our families, between husband and wife, between parents and children, between disciple and guru. People will get critical of their gurus. No, he didn't recognize me enough. He didn't appreciate me. I wasn't treated nicely. So how do we cultivate this other mood? What do we want? The ocean of bitterness and poison and regret? Or do we want the ocean of rasa, amrita, of tastes, of this infinite variety of tastes that gives us life and vitality? So this means to meditate on the greatness of Krishna and the greatness of Krishna's devotees, such that we feel inspired to help them, and that we consider it's an honor and a privilege to help, and that helping and that service is our reward. As Krishna said to the gopis, let your service be its own reward. Again, I'm sure we've experienced this sometimes when we were so much in love with something genuine, where we really cared about someone and we just wanted to help them because we cared about someone. And our service to them was itself the reward, even if they didn't notice it. Even if nobody noticed it. Even if we didn't get anything back. Just that feeling of service was itself the reward. Prabhupada talks about this with a mother and a little baby. I think this is especially true in the first 6 weeks of life, when the baby gives you absolutely no reciprocation. Starting at about 6 weeks, they smile at you. But those first 6 weeks, they give you no reciprocation. They basically don't even know you're there as a separate person. You're totally the servant of this child. Prabhupada talks about that the mother's love is a pure love because they're not expecting any return. The happiness the mother's getting at that time is just from the service itself. So I'm sure we've all had some little glimpse of this, like I had that little glimpse in Bloemfontein. And this means meditating on the greatness of others rather than on our own greatness. And it's interesting how difficult that seems to be for most of us. You know, when people complain to me about so-and-so devotee, oh, that Krishna Dasi, and I say, well, can you see the good in them? And sometimes there's a long silence. What good? How interesting that we don't have difficulty meditating on the good in ourselves. although we know we have so many faults. Yes? Do we all have so many faults? Yes? Maybe you guys don't, but I do. I mean, if I were to write a book of my faults, it'd be a long book. But still, I can meditate on what's good about myself. I don't have a problem with that at all. So why can't we meditate on what's good in others? Now, Prabhupada wrote this lovely letter, I think it was to Atre Rishi, about how even though the devotees are full of faults because they're persons, still those faults don't matter because they've dedicated themselves to Krishna's service. I mean, Krishna is so amazing that he sees the good qualities in Putana, who came to kill him. Would you see any good qualities in someone who came to kill you? If someone came to kill you by poisoning a cup of milkshake, would you see, well, at least they were offering me some food? Would you see that? You know, come to my house for dinner. Here's some nice food for you to eat, but there's poison in the milkshake. Would you say, well, they have good qualities because they invited me over for dinner? Are you kidding? But that's how Krishna thinks. He thinks, well, Putana offered me her breast to suck, so she's my mommy. Amazing. So that's Krishna's view. Krishna sees the good when someone says, oh, those nasty Hare Krishnas. Oh, they said my name. You know, if somebody says, oh, that nasty Urmila, I don't say, wow, they're thinking of me. I don't see any good in them at all. So this is Krishna's view. And it's interesting in the fourth canto of Bhagavatam, in the discussion between Daksha and Lord Shiva. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur gives his description of one who sees good qualities and one who sees bad qualities. And he says the lowest level is if you see someone's faults as potential good qualities. That's the lowest level of seeing the good in others. You see their faults, but you see, well, if they were used another way, they could be good qualities. The next higher level is you see both the faults and the good qualities, but you focus your attention on the good qualities. The next is you don't see the faults, you only see the good qualities. And the highest level is even if there's no good qualities, you see them anyway. You somehow see this is a soul, they're a part of Krishna. So if we're going to really engage in bhakti for Krishna and the devotees, we meditate on Krishna and we meditate on the devotees such that we feel inspired and we feel affectionate. And we all know how to do this. All of us have somebody or something in life that we're attached to and we feel affectionate for. And with that person or that thing, we meditate on the good. That's what we do. How do parents love obnoxious children? Have you ever wondered that? Have you ever seen parents with really obnoxious children and the parents still love them? How do they love them? Because they see the good in them. Even when there's not much good to see, they see the good in them. We all know how to do that. We've all done that. Now, with Krishna, there's only good, so it's easy to meditate on the good. In fact, with anyone who's trying to serve Krishna, the good far outweighs the bad. And anyone who's trying to serve Krishna, it's just going to be a matter of a second of universal time before they're pure and in the spiritual world. Even if that person's going to take another 3-4 lifetimes, each lifetime is only 8 billionths of a second for Lord Brahma. So even if you see some devotee who's really struggling and has some obnoxious habits, apichetsu charachara. You see, this person, it's just going to be a matter of, you know, a few billionths of a second before they're dancing with Krishna in the forest of Vrindavan. So this is bhakti. This is service. And whenever we come to do something, if we're sweeping the floor, we're washing the pots, we're making the sabji, we're making the garlands, we're distributing books, we're leading the kirtan, it should always be with the mood that these are great souls. Krishna is great, Prabhupada is great, all these souls are great. How fortunate I am that even though I'm nothing, I'm allowed to do some service for them. They're allowing me to render something. And my satisfaction is in that. My satisfaction isn't in being recognized for my greatness as a philanthropist. So this is my, this mood of affection and despair. How can I ever serve enough? How can I ever get enough with the devotees? Then we can be talking about Uttam Bhakti. Of course, there's other aspects to Uttam Bhakti which I'm not going to talk about tonight, and I don't even want to discuss them at all. Anyabhilasita sunyam, gyanakarma anavritam, anukulena. I don't want to talk about that aspect of the definition of bhakti tonight. I just really want to focus on this anushilanam, this aspect of activity. So this is the mood. And if the mood's not there, then the things we'll talk about tomorrow and the next day are only going to help us after a very, 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 very long time. So, again, tomorrow we'll talk about the 64 angas. Hopefully we'll do our little game and the 9 processes. And the next day we'll talk about serving Krishna in the world. But with this mood, that I'm serving Krishna with my body, I'm serving Krishna and the devotees with my body, I'm serving Krishna and the devotees with my speech, I'm serving Krishna and the devotees with my mind, and my inner mood is that of affection and despair, that there's real emotion there, that I have this mood of a servant. And when we do that, we are swimming not just in the Pacific Ocean, which is awfully big, but in an unlimited ocean. And an unlimited ocean of amrita, of vitality, of life, of strength, of health and energy, and of rasa, of all varieties of tastes of pleasure. Every variety of taste that one can imagine. And all we have to do is flip this switch from I'm the great to I'm the servant. That's it. It's not some big fancy thing. So we could have, we're going to stop at 6:30 for the party. If we have any questions, comments, discussions, additions, subtractions, etc.
It doesn't seem that...
Wait, we have a question here first. No, go ahead first. Yes, go ahead. No, the person in the room here.
Switch to switch, but we causelessly, which we don't really can't fully understand at this time, we've causelessly left Krishna out of envy, and for billions upon billions of innumerable births, we've been envious against Krishna, trying to usurp his position. It doesn't seem that easy to just flip the switch and feel affection. And affection is a real emotion from the heart. Brahmananda, back in the early days, one time...
One second. Can all of you who's listening on the computer, can you hear Narahari Prabhu or no? Okay, so let me repeat what he said. Let me repeat what you said so far. Okay, so you said, as hopefully I'll get it right, that it doesn't seem so easy because for so many billions of years we've been envious of Krishna. So flicking
that, causeless
unwillingness to serve, and therefore it doesn't seem so easy to flick that switch.
And I was going to give the example that Brahmananda, in the early days, one time everyone was offering obeisances to Prabhupada. He said, Prabhupada, sometimes I don't feel like offering obeisances. Should I do it anyway?
Okay, so Narayana was giving the example that Brahmananda said to Prabhupada, everyone's offering obeisances, but sometimes I don't feel like it. Should I do it anyway?
And Prabhupada said, yes.
And Prabhupada said, yes, you should do it.
So it seems that, of course, Prabhupada was understand that would come in time. It doesn't seem like that can just... tell me where the switch is so I can turn the
okay,
on.
So you're saying the Prabhupada said it would come in time, and where is the switch? My answer to that is we got to know what we're trying to do. So even if you're going to say it's going to come in time, you have to have a goal. You have to have a sadhya. You have to know where you're going. What are you trying to achieve in bhakti? Otherwise, you won't notice if you're getting there or not. Exactly like if you're going to make a physical journey from one location to another. Like today, Yugala Rasa took me out to a certain store that I wanted to go to. So you have to know where you're going. You have a very specific destination. I want to get to this place. And then there's landmarks, like if you give somebody directions, you say, okay, turn at this street, you'll see the street sign, or here it's over here, looks like this, it looks like this. So we want to know, what is pure bhakti? What does it look like? What does it feel like? So that we can intentionally cultivate it, just like we were reading from Nectar of Instruction, Text 6, where Prabhupada says bhakti is a sort of cultivation. What am I cultivating? So Prabhupada would say, you see a small spark, you fan it. When we have those moments of the real thing, we want to fan it. But in order to do that, you got to know what is the moment you're looking for. Another example would be if you want to train an animal. Let's say you want to train a chicken to dance. Okay? Who doesn't want to train a chicken to dance? So how do you do that? You want to train a chicken to move in a clockwise direction. So what you're going to do, you're going to watch the chicken. And if it takes a step to the right, you give it a piece of corn. And the chicken's figuring out, what did I do? What did I do? What did I do? And then again, the next time it takes a step to the right, you give it a piece of corn. Pretty soon the chicken figures out, oh, if I take one step to the right, I get a piece of corn. Now once the chicken figures that out and starts regularly taking a step to the right, you stop giving it a piece of corn for one step to the right. Then the chicken thinks, well, now what do I have to do? Then if the chicken accidentally takes two steps to the right, you give it a piece of corn. You reward little things in the right direction until your chicken is going in circles. Does this make sense to everybody? But if you don't know what's the ultimate behavior you want from the chicken, how are you going to know what little steps in that direction to reward? The trainer has to have already in mind, I want my chicken to make a circle in a clockwise direction. So we have to know, what is it that I'm trying to achieve here? What is my goal? My goal is to be serving Krishna and the Vaishnavas with body, minds, and words, with the mood of affection and despair. That's my goal. So whenever there's a little bit of movement in that direction, fan it. And then a little bit more movement in that direction, fan it. Otherwise, if you don't know what you're trying to achieve, then you can be taking yourself in the wrong direction, and you'll be patting yourself on the head that, you know, like a one devotee said, oh, I've now chanted my 16 rounds for 108 days. So that, you know, I got out my calculator, and I thought, how many days have I been chanting 16 rounds now? You know, I calculated it's been more than 14,600. But is that the point? I mean, not that I should, but that's not important. But is that the point? I had waved so many sticks of incense. You follow what I'm saying? So we don't want to fall into the trap that, well, because it's a gradual process and it'll come eventually, I'm just going to kind of wait for it to fall on me. I'm just going to do things, you know, I'm just going to serve with my body, with my words I'm going to be offensive, with my mind I'm going to be offensive, I'm not going to have any awareness of what my mood is, and I'm just going to go on and figure everything's going to fall on my head one day. One day I'm going to jump out of bed and say, oh, Krishna, I love you. But it's an intentional sort of cultivation. It's an intentional sort of cultivation. So we've got to know, what is bhakti? How are we going to cultivate it if you don't know what it is? And then cultivate it in yourself and in others. Is that a reasonable answer for your question? Okay, somebody over our vast electronic network here. If I can. One second, let me plug in the right thing here in the right place.
We have three questions lined up. So, Kandita, you were first.
Okay, hi, Krishna. Irmala Prabhu. Now, we're talking about like trying to find good qualities in everyone, no matter what. So if someone is blaspheming or criticizing or fault-finding other devotees, can we still find good qualities in that? I mean, aren't there situations or persons that, or devotees that, you know, that doesn't seem like a good idea. I hope I'm phrasing my question right. Probably not.
Should we be avoiding them? Yes, you should be avoiding them, but you shouldn't be criticizing the criticizers for criticizing. Let me blaspheme the blasphemers for their blasphemy. You know, that becomes rather ridiculous. And Prabhupada would say that Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati was pleased with any article that mentioned Krishna's name, even if it was critical. So if somebody would write an article, Krishna is bad, Krishna is this, Krishna... Or, you know what's really interesting is in the Bhagavatam, these demons are saying all this terrible criticism of Krishna, and the acharyas take the criticism and turn it inside out and upside down to how the demons are actually praising Krishna, which is really fascinating. You know, where was I just reading that? Was it Jarasandha or Rukmi? I can't remember. Shishupal, I was just listening to the kidnapping of Rukmini, and one of those bad guys, can't remember which one it was saying how Krishna was, he was the lowest of all persons, instead of Purushottama, Purusha Adama. And Prabhupada says the acharyas will say that the demons are saying Krishna is the lowest, but what they're really saying is Krishna pushes everyone else down, therefore he's the highest. So they say Sarasvati dances on their tongue. So the acharyas take the words of the demons and twist them around so that they're really praising Krishna. So if somebody is blaspheming the devotees, at least they're saying the names of the devotees. That's nice. That doesn't mean we want to associate with them. We don't want to associate with them. But someone who says Krishna's name, we offer them all respect. So if somebody's going around, oh, that Krishna Das, he's really just an envious demon. Oh, that Krishna Dasi, she's really just a this and a this and this. Wow, they're saying Krishna's name. You're meditating on the devotees. Eventually, even if you met Yamkrota Kama Sahaja Pranayati Bhitti Vatsalya Mohan Guru Guru Vasavi Bhavai Sanchin Chachasram Sadhusim Tanamapurete Govinda Manipurusham Kamahambhujami, even if you're meditating on Krishna with anger, with envy, now that's not bhakti, but how nice that they're meditating on the devotees. Eventually, they'll become purified. And you can understand that people who are blaspheming the devotees, I mean, if it's devotees blaspheming the devotees, they're probably doing it because they're thinking this is my way to purify the movement and so forth. So we can celebrate their external intentions. But no, we don't associate with them, and we should try to rectify them if at all possible. But still we see that this person has some good intentions, or at least they're saying Krishna's name. And if a person has no good qualities, then at least you can see they're part and parcel of Krishna. Jivaraswari Pyra Nichara Krishna Das. Everyone is a part and parcel of Krishna. Therefore, everybody, ultimately, as a soul, has all good qualities. Yes?
There was a man who lived down the street, and his daughter was friends with the devotees, but they would say, you can't go to the Hare Krishna temple. They were always saying this.
Okay, one second. Let me repeat it. So, Madhana here is saying there was a man, Jai, who lived down the street, and he was always telling their daughter, don't be friends with the devotees. Yeah?
And she couldn't come to the Krishna
temple. She couldn't come to the Krishna temple.
Then, as an adult, she came.
As an adult, she started coming.
When she was here one day, her father fell ill and went to the hospital and was leaving his body.
So one day when she was here, her father got ill, went to the hospital, and was leaving his body.
So we gave her tilak, radhakund, garland, neck beads, and tulsi.
Okay, so then the devotees gave her tilak, radhakund, garlands,
neck beads,
and tulsi for her dying father.
And when he left his body, he was wearing them.
And when he left his body, he was wearing them. So even though he had spent his life criticizing the devotees.
And now the mother, who was also in the same mood, has come to help do service.
And then the mother, who was in that same mood before, has come to help do service. So even if you say Krishna's name like that eventually, but... certainly we should keep our distance from blasphemers and just wish them well from a distance. So now we're going to have Aarti for Panchajatva. Thank you very much. All glories to Shiva.